city of Rome marks the end of a week-long occasion known as the U.S. Human Rights Week. The annual event commemorates a series of tragic incidents that killed hundreds of Iranians. The last day of the week, which falls on July the 3rd, marks the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board. After more than three decades, Iran is still waiting for an apology from the U.S. The American Human Rights Week also commemorates the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the terror attack. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been holding regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania. The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls in the same period on the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries. The 1981 attempted assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO is also among the incidents that's marked in the American Human Rights Week. Iran says the U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents that fall in this fateful week. Activists here say Washington has so far shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that is why Iran marks the American Human Rights Week every year to present documented instances of gross violations of human rights by the U.S., at least in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Over 1 month since a ceasefire came into force between the Israeli regime and Hamas, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip still suffer from psychological trauma and feel unsafe. While fears are rising of another round of violence, Palestinians mark 15 years of a land, air, and sea Israeli blockade that has devastated Gaza's economy and caused widespread destruction, leaving most people largely cut off from the outside world.
The Israeli blockade imposed for 15 years led Palestinians to call for simple solutions. This blockade, of course, affected all life aspects, especially the rate of poverty and unemployment. There are many graduates who are jobless now. Wars and Israeli blockade isolated Gaza from the world, and it's not surprising that many countries know nothing about Gaza.
Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip affected badly on all life aspects, leading to high rates of poverty and unemployment. Most of the working-age population in the Gaza Strip are unemployed and without any source of income due to the lack of job opportunities.
There are a lot of graduated people without a job in Gaza. The unemployment rate is high and there are no job opportunities. For 15 years, we have been living in the same situation. There has been continuous escalations and war over Gaza, and people will suffer from everything and nothing changes.
Due to the limited sources and restrictions imposed in movement and entry of goods and fuel, only a limited amount of fuel and cooking gas reach homes and the electricity plant. As a result, Gazans are suffering an electricity crisis that has devastated daily life, especially on clean water, as people in Gaza suffer from salty and polluted water that is not fit for drinking. Both the continuous violence over the Strip and the Israeli blockade affected badly on every aspect of life for Palestinians, isolating and depriving them from their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
We have a duty to fight for.
Stop denying racism and start dismantling it. Those were the unequivocal comments by Michelle Bachelet, the United Nations Human Rights Chief, following a landmark report launched after the killing of George Floyd in the United States, which called on countries worldwide to do more to tackle the systemic racism against people of African descent.
I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism, to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent, and to confront past legacies and deliver redress.
The report found that police use of racial profiling and excessive force was systemic in much of North America, Europe and Latin America.
We're suffering right across the world. Adam Traore in France, George Floyd in America, Dalian Atkinson and Kevin Clark here in the United Kingdom. You know, 24 people were shot in the favelas of African descent by Brazilian police, you know, in the last 12 months. So you can see that wherever you look.
It also concluded that racism was the biggest problem in countries steeped in the history of the transatlantic slave trade, which ultimately laid the foundations for much of the wealth they enjoy today.
The report highlighted the UK as one of 60 countries that needs to do more to help bring an end to systemic racism, notably urging them to apologise to people of African descent and make amends through reparations. Yet despite the UK playing a leading role in the transatlantic slave trade, so far, the British state has shown an unwillingness to do either.
Michelle Bachelet acknowledged the pivotal role that the Black Lives Matter movement played in bringing this conversation to the forefront, but accepted that now it's on states around the world to take concrete action and make amends for centuries of violence and discrimination. But for countries like the United Kingdom, just issuing an apology would be a start. Ahmed Kabbalo, London.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the US military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what US President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all US forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The US and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the US invasion failed to approve the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to U.S. media reports, more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which though failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he's expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says the removal of the Israeli regime and the liberation of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is closer than ever today. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah also said that the U.S. hegemony is the most dangerous threat that's facing the West Asian region. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the axis of resistance in the West Asia region has grown and what plans the U.S. and its allies may have to weaken it. First, let's cross on over to Beirut and talk to our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who will give us some highlights, Mariam, if you can, some of the most important points that Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stated today.
Well, usually the speeches of Sayyid Nasrallah are very much fruitful. There are so many details in there, but you mentioned one of them, which is very significant, that the liberation of Palestine, liberation of Al-Quds, is very close. And he believes that this is because the resistance force or the resistance alliance in the region is much stronger than it has in the past. He mentioned that the last 10 years or the last decade was one of the most difficult periods that the resistance was able to surpass. And at the same time, there are the different forms of resistance that are also very much in unity in trying to show this strength. And one of them is media, and that was one of the reasons why he was speaking today, to show that media is a partner in the victory that happened lately in the battle for Al-Quds, or the previous battles, or any battle in the future. And he stressed on that point that the media needs to highlight and needs to voice that need or that equation that all the leaders of the resistance are voicing, which is that if Jerusalem Al-Quds is under any aggression by the Israelis once again, like Sheikh Jarrah in the past, then therefore this would lead to a regional war and not only a confrontation between the Palestinian resistance in Gaza and the Israeli occupation forces. So that is also another very important point that he mentioned, and tried to strengthen it, of course, and to highlight that point.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Mariam Saleh there, correspondent from Beirut. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joins us from Brussels. And also joining us is historian and journalist Brent Jonkers, who joins us from Hasselt. I'd like to welcome you both, and let me start with you first, Brent Jonkers, if I may, and break down one of the highlights of what the Hezbollah Secretary General has said, and that is the U.S. hegemony is the most dangerous threat facing West Asia. Tell us if you agree with that, and in what ways, if you do agree with him, is that true?
Well, I think that's absolutely spot on. Like, the U.S. Hegemonistic imperialist venture in worldwide is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, threats that the world faces, and definitely in West Asia, or in like in the region that in the West is often called the Middle East, this hegemony is way more, it's all the more obvious, all the more aggressive, and all the more warmongering, especially in the past 20 years, ever since 2001. I think this is something that it should be so obvious by now that everyone who is not too blind or too unwilling to see it has to admit this. So the United States has, through various ways of meddling, interference, aggression, invasion, really spread its tentacles around West Asia and is trying to squeeze life out of it, and has been doing this for decades now. Of course, there is the constant bipartisan, as well, support from the United States to Israel to the tune of billions and billions of dollars every single year, both monetary, financial, as, of course, a military support. Then there is the support to various imperialist conflicts and the invasion of independent sovereign nations. Of course, we had the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the continuous occupation that still exists to this day, despite constant and repeated demands by Iraq, including the parliament, including the government of Iraq, that the United States has to leave. We've seen the United States' completely illegal invasion of northeastern Syria, the occupation of Hazakah and other areas in northeastern Syria under the guise of what they call the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is completely illegal according to any and all international humanitarian law, completely against the basic concept of national sovereignty of nations. We have seen the invasion in Libya. We have seen the overthrow and the infiltration in legitimate grievances, legitimate protests that existed in the wake of the Arab Spring in 2011, when the United States immediately decided to basically to butt in, to hijack any potential popular outbursts of anger and to steer them towards a way that will end up being more imperialist. And that is, I believe, what Sayed Nasrallah has been talking about when he says that the previous period has been so difficult for the resistance, and yet they succeed in overcoming it and defeating it and coming out stronger. This is that period, especially the last decade, that period of imperialist hijacking of this so-called Arab Spring movement and this massive support of Western imperialist powers to every form of reactionary government, reactionary movement, terrorist organization that wishes to overthrow legitimate governments and states that are too independent to the liking of the West. So all these things together, they constitute a very obvious, I think, evidence of the fact that, like Sayed Nasrallah said, that the United States' presence in this hegemony is the biggest threat that West Asia is facing right now, and probably the biggest threat they have faced in a very long time.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, another thing that Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said on the same topic is that the U.S. seeks to expand its hegemony by supporting Israel. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the U.S. Influence in the region really waning? Because when you took at certain countries like Syria, like Iraq, of course Iran, we know where that stands, even with Turkey and other countries, it's not really the support that it used to have, if you agree. And therefore, is that the possibility of this Abraham Accords to come into the picture, to have that relationship established between them and Israel, so that the U.S. remains, so to speak, a player, and at the same time, Israel is protected?
Well, we see that the role of the U.S. in the Middle East is parallel to the ultimate support of Israel and to keep its hegemony in the in West Asia, to prevent Russia, Iran, and China from moving in. We see that the U.S. hegemony is fading slowly but surely. However, the U.S. still has enough power to make sure that this is, the countries like, for example, Iraq, is under its thumb and threatening the Iraqi government with sanctions, like it is doing also with Iran, and is doing with Syria, and is doing with Lebanon. Therefore, yes, we see that the Americans are supporting Israel to unlimited level. However, the Israeli themselves can see that their power is also declining after the war in Lebanon 2006, after the failure of the partition of Syria and the partition of Iraq, and recently the sword of Jerusalem imposed by Gaza. Israel is no longer as strong as it used to claim to be, the strongest country in the Middle East or the strongest army in the Middle East. On the contrary, we saw that a small number of resistance of people who want to resist against the U.S. hegemony and against the Israeli expansion are managing to impose on Israel its deterrence and making sure that Israel cannot violate their sovereignty anytime Israel wants. And that affects also the U.S. control of the Middle East that is also going down. Particularly, we see in Syria, the Americans are starting to be under attack. In Iraq, they are under continuous attack by the resistance. Many countries don't want them anymore. They want them to leave. But what the only thing that the Americans are doing is making sure that to create havoc in the Middle East when they are not wanted, and they're not trying to do anything constructive.
Well, Brett Yockers, I noticed Elijah Magner again saying something along the lines that I said, and that is the support of the U.S. for the U.S. is not as it used to be. U.S. still has influence in the region. And Israel is not on the solid footing that it thought that it should be. I mean, if you really think about it, all the support, all the military aid that the U.S. gives Israel, and all the military hardware that the U.S. has spilt into the region, in retrospect, what has that gotten them? Reminds us of what Donald Trump said, that, you know, trillions of dollars, and what does the U.S. have to show for it? So when Hassan Nasrallah says that the U.S. seeks to expand its hegemony to continue its support for Israel, and at the same time, the removal of the Israeli regime and the liberation of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is closer than ever today, does that hold true in a way that it hasn't in the past, especially when we look at Palestine and the Gaza Strip coming fresh off that the win off that 11-day war?
I think that is absolutely it's absolutely true, and that is something it is often let's say obfuscated, especially of course in imperialist mass media, mainstream media. The fact that Israel is this, it claims to be this sort of giant, but it's a giant with a very very weak legs, let's say, to stand on. It cannot, the base of Israel itself, both militarily, ideologically, but even demographically, the base of Israel is extremely fragile. And the most interesting example of that, I think, is the fact that the former head of Shin Bet, which is the internal security service of the Zionist entity, he went to one of the leading newspapers of Israel just a couple of months ago, and he spoke openly in Zionist mainstream media, and he said that Israel will most likely not survive the coming generation, so the coming couple of decades. And the reason for that, he did not even speak necessarily of what will happen militarily, but he said demographically speaking, the support for Zionism in Israel is based for the most part on this, what they call these so-called liberal Jews, or these so-called non-religious Jews, so people who are in reality not religiously Jewish at all, but see themselves as still as some part of some sort of chosen race that has the right to this country. But this power base of Israel is, presentially speaking, declining, and especially when compared to other groups that live in the Zionist entity. And which group are those? The majority of the other groups that exist are what the Israeli call Israeli Arabs, but which in reality are Palestinians. The Palestinian population in Israel, especially after the 1967 war and the occupation of East Jerusalem and major parts, of course, of the West Bank, this population has been increasing gradually. And in general, they also have larger families, and they have their percentage, the share of the population, is rising. For obvious reasons that I don't think I need to explain, the Palestinians who live in quote-unquote Israel, generally speaking, do not support the Zionist entity or the Zionist project. And the interesting part is that another part of the Zionist population that is growing really massively and exponentially is the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, people who are actually religiously Jewish. And the interesting thing here is that a big part of these religious Jews also don't support the Zionist entity as it exists. These are Jews who just want to practice their faith. Yes, of course, they want to live in the area where they live in, but they don't necessarily support a Zionist Jew-only state, because they know that they don't need a Jewish-dominated state in order to be Jews. The Jews have lived for thousands of years all across the world, especially in the Middle East, especially in Islamic and Christian nations in the Middle East. They have lived there peacefully and generally unharmed. And these people know that it is possible for a Palestinian state to be multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and still maintain a sort of peaceful coexistence between Jewish, Christians, and Muslims. And so all these things together, that is just purely the demographic point of view. Even if there was no conflict happening, this is what the Shin Bet leader said, even without the conflict, Israel is demographically doomed to fail. Now, when you see, of course, the resistance coming on top of that, this resistance is growing as well exponentially. You have the resistance in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, mm-hmm. which is increasing their activities more and more and more. And this will come to blows sooner or later, and which will eventually, I believe, lead to the destruction of the Zionist project and the Zionist colonial entity on the land of Palestine.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, Elijah, if you don't mind expanding more about the axis of resistance. Is something that the U.S. and its allies have not appreciated. They have tried to break that up. How far along have they come, or have they actually been defeated in that journey? Because as it stands, the axis of resistance, if anything, it appears that they've grown stronger. We can take a look at the most recent 11-day war. The Palestinian resistance factions were able to claim victory over that. Many agree that that is indeed what happened. Is that the reality, the new reality, the axis of resistance unbreakable and to have grown stronger, and the U.S. perhaps has been defeated in trying to break that up?
Well, yes, using different methods. So we see the Americans tried to use boots on the ground by occupying Afghanistan and Iraq, and it didn't work. We saw Israel trying to defeat Hezbollah and didn't work, and exactly the same in Gaza. And we saw also that in Yemen and through Saudi hands. So now the Americans are trying something else that is called the soft power. And the soft power is to turn the inhabitants against one another. And this is what they are trying in Iraq. And we can't say they are succeeding, but they have succeeded in creating a domestic havoc and turning the population one against another by using legitimate requests like corruption and job opportunities and the lack of basic services. And they use that also in Lebanon. They're imposing sanctions on Syria to turn the population against the government in Damascus. So they're no longer using the military, because point they have been defeated militarily. And we saw that Iran move to the level of full empowerment when it has bombed Ain al-Assad, the largest U.S. base, which means sending a direct message to the American that I am ready to fight face to face, and I no longer need to rely on my allies to do the job, but we all are on the same line. Therefore, there is a new method, and this new method is going toward the population and creating a storm internally and trying to turn people against each other, or the population, the society against the government. And this way, they impoverish the population, they don't care about it, and they create such a discontent so the population blame anybody, including the axis of the resistance, and in this case, in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and in Gaza, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and in Syria, the Syrian government, and in Iraq, the Hashdi Shabi, or the Iraqi resistance groups that are against the U.S. occupation forces. And partially, they have succeeded partially in doing so. Now it is up to the people to be more aware of the American doing and understand that patience is their best weapons, and that this is part of the war that Israel and the Americans are waging against them because they've been defeated militarily. As simple as that.
Trying to figure out exactly what is going on, Fred Jonkers, when it comes to Syria and the U.S. position. Seyed Hassan Nasrallah did condemn the U.S. airstrikes that happened in the same area, the Syria-Iraq border. And it seems like the U.S. has a focus on Syria that it has not changed from the past, and that is obviously the ultimate goal, is this obsession with having Assad be removed. It even goes as far as talking to its allies, saying do not establish a relationship with Assad, even though they want to at this point have accepted the fact that, you know, Assad's there to stay. It had elections, he was reelected. Why is the U.S. so keen on its focus on Syria? Is it because of Israel, to make sure that that pathway is there so that Israel can continue its attacks on Syria?
I think that is absolutely a very important influence. We can never underestimate the influence of the Zionist entity and the Zionist lobbies on anything, especially foreign policy, that the United States is doing. We have seen now in the 11-day war, in the entire conflict, the sort of Al-Quds battles, that the Palestinian resistance suddenly, almost seemingly suddenly, had a very modern state-of-the-art equipment at their possession that they most likely have had in their arsenal for quite some time, but now have really been showing. And that that a lot of this arsenal most likely comes through Syria into Palestine. This is one of the big accomplishments as well of the Shahid Qasem Soleimani, of course, is the support of this bringing of modern equipment to Palestine through support and supporters and resistance members and resistance organizations in both Iraq and Syria. And that way you get into occupied Palestine. And eventually into the still free part of Palestine, which is Gaza. So when this focus on Syria keeps on going, not so much in the media anymore, because the United States and the Western allies, they try, of course, to sort of downplay the fact that they are still there, that right. They are actually occupying a big part of northeastern Syria, illegally, without even so much as a UN mandate. But this conflict keeps on going. Today, still, there was a report that broke that 45 trucks were seen trucking oil and grain from Syria, stealing it from Syria, and crossing into Iraq to go to American bases. So this is all part, for a big part, of course, of this Israeli Zionist focus on trying to keep on dismantling and balkanizing Syria, with the eventual goal, of course, of destroying Syria as a country entirely.
Yeah, sorry to jump in. I'm going to ask the last question from Elijah Mack here. At the end of his speech, Elijah, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah talked about Lebanon and that this should not be the state of Lebanon and the reason why it's experiencing such harsh financial meltdown, if you want to call it that, is because the U.S., he didn't put all the blame on the U.S., but he said the U.S. is preventing Lebanon from getting investments into the country because of the sanctions that have occurred, and that it is a major factor in the prevention of Lebanon from advancing to try to bring itself out of the hole that it's in. Is that, again, because of Israel that the U.S. may be doing that? Because Seyed Hassan Nasrallah and the resistance movement is there in Lebanon?
Hezbollah is the strongest, one of the strongest armies in the Middle East. It is organized but a regular army, and it represents a real danger to Israel. And as I said previously, Israel tried to defeat it and failed. So the only possibility now is to go to internal domestic bickering. And what the problem of Lebanon is, the U.S. support to its allies that are accused of corruption throughout the last three decades. These are the people who are not satisfied with what's happening in Lebanon. They're preventing China from coming in. They're preventing Iran from sending oil paid by the Lebanese with Lebanese lira, local currency that nobody wants, and preventing Russia from reconstructing the country. That is what the Americans are doing. So the pressure remains not only on Hezbollah, but also the society that supports Hezbollah. That is Shia.
Yeah, unfortunately, I got to jump in. I'm sorry, we're just fresh out of time. That's Elijah Magnier. Thank you, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, historian and journalist Brent Yonkers, for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Yikova Tahwe, and the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The new UK Health and Social Care Secretary, Sajid Javid, has said the best way to protect the nation's health was by lifting the main COVID-19 restrictions. He said rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. We're prepared for an article written by Linda Geeds. The piece is titled, UK Scientists Caution That Lifting of COVID Rules is Like Building Variant Factories. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more. UK scientists have warned that the lifting of all COVID-19 restrictions is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate, and said the attitude of the new Health and Social Care Secretary Sajid Javid is frightening. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, on 4th of July, Sajid Javid said the best way to protect the nation's health was lifting the main COVID-19 restrictions. He said rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. Reacting to the comments, Professor Stephen Riker of the University of St Andrews in Scotland, a member of the SAGE subcommittee advising on behavioural science, tweeted, "It is frightening to have a health secretary who still thinks COVID is flu, who is unconcerned at levels of infection, who doesn't realize that those who do best for health also do best for the economy, who wants to ditch all protections while only half of us are vaccinated. Professor Stephen Riker said, above all, it's frightening to have a health secretary who wants to make all protections a matter of personal choice, when the key message of the pandemic is, this isn't an I thing, it's a we thing. In the coming days, the cabinet is expected to sign off on the easing of various COVID restrictions in England, including allowing fully vaccinated adults to travel to Amber-list countries without having to self-isolate when they return home, making wearing of face masks voluntary, apart from in hospitals and other healthcare settings, and no longer requiring fully vaccinated adults to take a COVID-19 test or self-isolate if they've come into contact with an infected person. The school bubble system that has forced hundreds of thousands of pupils to self-isolate at home if someone in their bubble tests positive is also expected to be dropped, while pub and restaurant customers may no longer have to scan an NHS QR code upon their arrival. Health Secretary Sajid Javid said, "We need to be clear that cases are going to rise significantly. I know many people will be cautious about the easing of restrictions. That's completely understandable. But no date we choose will ever come without risk, so we have to take a broad and balanced view." He added, "We are going to have to learn to accept the existence of COVID and find ways to cope with it, just as we already do with the flu." Professor Susan Michie, a director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London and another member of SAGE's Behavioural Science Subcommittee, tweeted, "Allowing community transmission to surge is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate." Writing in a blog for the British Medical Journal last week, Professor Susan Michie, together with Professor Riker and Professor Anne Phoenix at University College London's Institute of Education, said Health Secretary Sajid Javid's singular emphasis on responsibility of individuals to identify and mitigate against COVID-19 risks took the emphasis away from what the government must also do. They said, "If people are to act responsibly, they need their government to fulfill its own responsibilities to make safe behavior possible." The fear is that when government talks about a freedom day, when all restrictions are lifted, it doesn't mean that the virus has gone away, and it doesn't mean that the measures are not needed to prevent a resurgence. They noted, "What it does mean is that the government is planning to withdraw all forms of support and abandon us to deal with the pandemic on our own." However, other scientists have said the relaxation of many of the restrictions, while not risk-free, actually made sense. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at the University of East Anglia, said, "Double vaccinated people are less likely to get an infection, and even if infected, are less likely to infect others." Similarly, he said, the additional risk posed by relaxing mask wearing was unlikely to be great, although it made sense for vulnerable groups to wear face masks in crowded indoor environments, and for those visiting very vulnerable individuals indoors, at least whilst community rates remained high. Professor Paul Hunter said, "The school bubble system may have had some value, but if we accept that we're all going to get repeated SARS-CoV-2 infections throughout life, and we are unlikely to vaccinate children under the age of 11 and may not vaccinate children from 11 to 16, then all this can be said to be doing is delaying the inevitable. This is causing considerable disruption for relatively little benefit." He added, "Even relying on daily testing of asymptomatic individuals is open to debate." Professor Paul Hunter noted, "Of course, We have seen new issues appear during the course of this epidemic, and so no one can be certain of the challenges over coming months. But we will eventually come into an equilibrium with this virus, as we have with all other endemic respiratory infections. Professor Alison Pollock, a clinical professor of public health at Newcastle University, claimed Health Secretary Jarvis' approach was sensible. She said, "Population immunity is rapidly being achieved due to a combination of naturally acquired immunity through infection and vaccination. Unknowns are duration of immunity, impact of variants, and who is at individual risk of reinfection or transmission." Professor Alison Pollock said, "Good infection and outbreak control measures are still important at local level. However, mass testing and daily testing should be stopped, as testing of asymptomatic people is causing unnecessary harm with no evidence that it contributes to reducing transmission." Meanwhile, according to a report, more than one in four young people are worried that poor mental health will affect their ability to find work after the COVID-19 pandemic. After the opening up of the British economy this spring, the Resolution Foundation said young workers were still suffering a heavier toll than their older colleagues and were paying a heavier price with their mental health. It said that 18 to 24-year-olds were 2.5 times more likely at the end of May to be out of work or still on furlough than any other age group, even after the reopening of hospitality venues across the United Kingdom as activity returns to Britain's high streets. It comes amid mounting concerns over the lasting impact of the crisis for young people after 15 months of unprecedented disruption to their education and the start of their working lives. With separate research published recently by the Institute for Fiscal Studies warning that those getting on the career ladder for the first time could bear the scars of the COVID recession for years to come. Despite the opening up of the economy this spring, the Resolution Foundation said more than one in five adults aged between 18 and 24 reported struggles with mental health last month. In a survey of more than 8,000 adults undertaken by YouGov on behalf of the think tank and the Health Foundation charity, fewer than half, or 48%, said their mental health was good. This compared with a much higher rate of 64% for 55-year-olds to 64-year-olds. More than one in four, or 27%, of 18 to 24-year-olds said they were worried about finding a job in the coming months because of their mental health situation, compared with about one in five people aged between 35 and 54, and only one in 10 aged between 55 and 64. Rukmin Sehmi, a senior research and policy analyst at the Resolution Foundation, said young people have been hit hardest by the COVID-19 economic crisis, which has taken its toll on their mental health. Rukmin Sehmi said, "Worryingly, some young people are struggling even while the economy is recovering, and they are fearful about their career prospects. These fears must not be underestimated." The evidence comes as the Institute for Fiscal Studies said young adults were battling greater challenges in the world of work than their older peers as pandemic restrictions are relaxed. The influential think tank said there were growing risks that young workers would bear the scars of the COVID-19 recession for years to come. It said young adults had avoided sliding into poverty during the crisis because of the government's furlough scheme, and as they chose to delay the start of their careers by staying at home, living with their parents while the pandemic continues. Official figures show that under-25s have accounted for two-thirds of the decline in employment in the United Kingdom during the coronavirus pandemic and are more likely to be placed on furlough than older staff.
Good morning.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English.